Whatever.
Good morning, members. We are going to start with Senator Saxog, Senate File 386. Senator Saxog, initiative to remove seasonal rec from the state general tax. Statewide business property tax, I guess. Welcome, Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate being here today and members. Today, as you said, we're presenting Senate File 386. This bill makes changes to seasonal recreational residential property. It will provide property tax relief and equity in school funding in the Minnesota Lake Country. What it really does is return seasonal recreational property classification to the 2001 status. And, I think that we all know that a large percentage of most of these school districts is public land, which, of course, affects tax base. And to quote one of our colleagues over in the House, Senator Dill, these properties are Lake Country's commercial property. It's what these small towns and small school districts, many of them exist because of the recreational area. So, with that today, with me today are Sam Allseth with the Rural Education Association, Jim Atchison with the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, and Deb Wanick, Superintendent of Pelican Rapids. And she's going to give some brief testimony, Mr. Chair.
Dave, thank you, Senator. And I didn't catch the name of the superintendent, Superintendent
Deborah Wanick.
Wanick, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to address this committee with the... I'm sorry. I'm Deb Wanick, Superintendent of Pelican Rapids School District. And again, thank you for letting me share some of the impact of this. I think of the complexities that you deal with, and I really appreciate the intensity it must take to examine that. I think of our federal government trying to balance their budget, and if an incidental law had accidentally taken 50% of the tax base of Minnesota away, and they had taken the wealthiest group and left Minnesota with the poorest part, it would be very hard on the state of Minnesota. And that's how I feel. That's our picture. We had 50% of the seasonal value taken away. We had, 50% of our taxable market value is seasonal rec. So when that was taken away, we had 50% left to work with. And we have a 50% free and reduced group in school, so it truly is the poorest group. So when we try to pass a levy, it's very difficult. And schools, as you know, are relying on levies. I think if you have the sheet that with the Pelican Rapids letterhead, it gives some of the statistics of our school. Again, 50% free and reduced, 30% students of color. And then it talks again about the 50% of the taxable market value was the seasonal rec. Just some of the numbers down below for our district alone. If a referendum market value home was $100,000, the tax currently right now would be $159. If the new law changes, it would be $68. And just to the right of that, we have seasonal rec at $100,000. And if they pay $121 to the state, if it were to change, it would be $68 in the referendum value. So it really is important for us. When we've been trying to pass levies, it took us four times that we did pass one, but we had a lot of people who live year-round on the lake say, why should I pay tax when the home right next to me is $1 million and they don't pay any of the school tax? So I can understand their frustration when they have that kind of competition. When seasonal rec, sometimes people think of a little cabin, this little hunting shack on the corner, but we have a lot of lakes and some very wealthy homes. We're so close to North Dakota that Fargo people often have a lake home around us. If you look on the second sheet, data from 2010, that shows a number of school districts and how it impacts them. It gives you the name of the school. And four columns over, it has the total market value, then the seasonal rec, the percentage of seasonal rec, and the percentage of free and reduced. This is 2010, and Pelican Rapids, I highlighted there, we now have 50% free and reduced and almost 50% seasonal rec. So it is a huge impact on our district. So I would really implore you to consider passage of this law because it affects so many people.
And Superintendent, could you tell me, does your school district currently qualify for any equalizing dollars, or is your...
Equalizing dollars?
Yes, for the levy.
No, we do not, because when you take the wealth of our district, they say that the average home is over $200,000. Well, you look in our little town, and we have very,
So when like you've done your voter-approved referendum, it would all be local effort. There would be no state aid involved. Okay, thank you. Senator Saxog, the other witness.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said before, Jim Atchison with the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers is with us to give some brief testimony also.
Mr. Atchison.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Atchison, Hennepin County Assessor and member of the MAAO Legislative Committee. MAO is supporting this bill as it fits into the legislative position statement of MAO, where we are looking at taxation based on market value as a major component of a diverse budget-based tax base, and such a system should be based on fair and equitable tax base, a reliable source of revenue for local taxing authorities, accountable and justifiable between similar properties, and understandable and transparent to taxpayers. MA also supports a system where the classification system is more understandable and the continued consolidation of existing classes, where, again, it makes it easier for the taxpayers to understand. The administrative costs are streamlined to local governments, and this bill fits that criteria. It's a very good step in that direction, where as the assessors refer to, is a house is a house. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Atchison. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you both. And there's a couple of other folks that have asked to testify, Mr. Walseth and Mr. Forrester.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Sam Walseth. I lobby for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. What we're asking, MREA is very supportive of the legislation before you, and basically we're asking you to undo or reverse a decision that was made in 2001, whereby the state of Minnesota decided it would collect a tax on seasonal recreational properties in the statewide levy, but not allow local school districts to collect that revenue. Unfortunately, in the last decade, operating referenda have become really the safety valve of education funding. You have struggled with deficits. We're all well aware of that. But operating referenda have become the name of the game for a lot of school district basic program financing. But that tax law change from 2001 has really put a central Minnesota, Lakes Country, Minnesota school districts at a major disadvantage, and really has placed a big burden on the homeowners when districts ask for those referenda dollars, and many of those districts have failed in those efforts. We believe, and Mr. Chairman, members, you're going to hear a lot of bills today that kind of taken together would do a lot of really good things for school districts, but this is one step in that forward in that process of returning some basic equity and stability, giving these central Minnesota Lakes Country districts an opportunity to generate the dollars that they need for their students.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, would you support a constitutional amendment to let the owners of cabins vote in the on the operating referendum? I have hundreds, if not thousands, of people who own cabins in my district, one of the biggest in the state of cabin owners. The biggest complaint I've heard over the years, until we made the change in 2001, is we have to pay and we don't get any service. Our kids are not in those schools. We have to pay for the operating referendum in our own school districts. Even if we don't have children there, we understand that because we have a voice and we can vote. Would you support that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, if you take that logic to its logical conclusions, you're going to have we're going to have one heck of a referendum process in the state about people voting. Would they be able to vote on the statewide levy, for instance, because the state is deciding to tax them? I would just say this.
That's not a referendum, sir. We're talking about when school districts put something on the ballot, or a city for that matter. The people that own property, I'm not talking about corporations or businesses, I'm talking about natural persons, they have to pay the operating referendum. They would have to pay the operating referendums in which they have no voice, not only in their own school districts where they have their homesteaded property, but then also in school districts where they happen to have a cabin. And I can assure you that most of my constituents don't own million-dollar homes in greater Minnesota.
Well, Senator Ress, it would require a pretty major change in the way voting is determined in this country. I mean, you've never had a requirement to own property for votes.
And Senator Scoy, I don't support that. But it seems to me that if people are saying that people who have no say-so whatsoever in the decisions that are made by local school districts, that's why we went to this system in 2001. And so that it was imposed by the state, the money came in and was supposed to be sent back out to the school districts. That lasted about a year and a half before that law was changed, and it just went into the general fund. But I think we should be very, very cautious about making this kind of change back. And I can assure you that at the time when we were doing this, I would have 400 cabin owners come to a town meeting talking about how unfair it was that they had to pay operating referendum levies in more than one school district.
And Senator Rest, all school districts have their property tax base, and they need the ability to raise revenue for their schools on what they have. Many businesses have owners or shareholders that are outside of the school jurisdiction. They're not allowed to vote on those referendums if they pay
that.
Taxes into their schools, because that's what the school district has as a tax base.
We're talking about, Mr. Chairman, we're talking about natural persons, not
Mr. Chairman,
not businesses. And I understand that, and I know it's difficult, and I want I want these school districts to prosper. But, if I don't speak up for my taxpayers, then nobody's going to.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the right policy is, I don't know if the legislature would have the courage, is just cancel all voter-approved levies. All in, all done. Those school districts that are getting $1,800 a pupil, none, gone.
Yep.
And those that are getting zero, like Pelican Rapids, they're still at zero. But we are creating a huge disparity in educational funding across the state by this increased reliance on voter-approved levies. And some districts are at a huge disadvantage in passing them. I was just up in the education committee this morning. The Lake Superior School District, over the last 5 years, has tried to run 3 voter-approved levies. They all have failed. They're on a 4-day school week. Those kids, they built a new school. They managed to get that passed back in 2002. Because the old one was falling down, and now they can't get a voter-approved levy. They can't heat their swimming pool. The kids are wearing stocking caps in class, and there are million-dollar cabins all up and down the shore of Lake Superior who are not participating one bit. And I'm not advocating for voter-approved levies. I'm advocating let's just get rid of them completely and turn this responsibility for funding K-12 over to the state where it belongs.
So I would agree with that.
Let the record show we have a quorum. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just addressed the committee and comments by Senator Rest. I really consider this seasonal property, this Lake Country property, kind of de facto commercial property.
I understand that.
And so it's like if the person who owns a McDonald's in Pelican Rapids has got the same problem, so probably. Anyway, I know you understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Forrester.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, and I represent Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, formerly MSRPO, Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. And I'd like to thank the committee for this chance to address you all on this on these bills. In 2001, when this tax reform policy was kind of being put together, Senator Rust was correct. There was a lot of excitement about the idea that, well, we can vote in at the state level and we'll be paying taxes into the local school districts. The money will still be going there. But, again, I think it was the following year or maybe a little bit longer than that, it was made part of the general fund, and that never happened. And I've heard from the same people Senator Rust has been hearing from about having to pay for levies that they can't vote in, but I've also heard the other side of the story. A lot of the people in these districts, lake districts, are a lot of the seasonal recreational property is someone lives in town like Virginia and they have a hunting shack outside of town. That's seasonal rec. It's not just the million-dollar homes on the lake. In fact, some of the districts with the most cabin owners living in them are up north. So that they're connected with these schools. A lot of the people, as in my family, comes from the district where the cabin is located. So my cousins all went through the schools in Tower. My grandmother lives up there. So we understand the problem of what's happened, I guess. And another part of the problem is since 2001, people will make the statement that cabin owners pay no school taxes. And we're kind of held out as a straw man, and we pay all the taxes except for the excess operating levies. And we recognize there's a need for a solution. Senator Saxhog's bill, along with the other bills being heard today, are all pieces of a rather complex puzzle. And frankly, we're not entirely clear on what the final result will be in terms of people's actual property tax bills or the amount of funding provided for each student in these districts by the state. So that's why we're here today, and we're glad to be having this discussion and be able to hear the questions that you all have as these kind of package of bills moves forward. Thank you for the time to speak.
Mr. Forster, you know, back when we had the 2A, 2B debate, at one point in the discussion, we had talked about taking these homes and move them into the non-homestead resident category, which is basically what many of them are, most of them are. And any of these structures would then be classified as that category as opposed to seasonal rec. And the seasonal rec category would have been more the vacant lands or the forest category. Do you have any thoughts about that, which would achieve a very comparable goal to this? You still wouldn't have your voting rights, as Senator Rest is concerned, but it would right. just get rid of the seasonal rec category.
Well, I know that there's some movement from the committee to look at the property tax working group. It's talking about narrowing getting rid of a lot of the property tax classifications. We were part of that study, I think, 2005, where they took some vacant land, an imagined description of rural land, and sent it out to assessors around the state, and it came back as, you know, assessed as non-homestead, as timber, as seasonal rec, as, you know, different things. And that's where that rural woodlands tax classification came out of, as a way to identify those rural vacant lands. I can see the reasoning. I guess I haven't really thought through all the implications of it, but.
Any other questions, members? Anything else, Senator Saxhog?
I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, that this will be laid on the table for possible future inclusion.
Yeah.
A motion to that effect, or would be good?
Yes, Senator Saxhog. We're going to lay Senate File 386 on the table for possible inclusion. but I wanted to see if there was anybody else in the audience that wanted to testify and if there were any more questions. Anyone who would else would want to speak on Senate File 386?
Just a question.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I see the revenue estimate in terms of loss in the state general levy. Do we have a property tax run on this in terms of what the property tax implications would be if we adopted this? Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I don't believe we do have that run.
I certainly would like to see how that's going to have an impact throughout the state and would request that.
Yeah, well, that would be good information, Senator Rest. We could see where the property gains are and where the losers are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good.
In fact, anything else? Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see that on all the bills that we have today.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, may I
say
one more thing?
Sure. Superintendent, come to back to the table.
Sorry, I'm a little nervous sitting in front, so I forgot this piece. I appreciate your willingness to look at equity in funding and education. That's been so important for us. If you look at the levy sheets, and it shows our referendum market value being about half of our taxable market value. And then when you pull Minneapolis's revenue, their actual referendum market value is larger than their taxable because of the exclusion that happened last year. So the exclusion affected the property value, but it didn't affect the referendum market value. So when you can see the disparity when half of ours is removed, and then in Minneapolis, theirs is actually larger because of some of the laws. So I appreciate I can't even imagine the intricacies that you must deal with when you're trying to make laws. But again, I just wanted to point out another piece of that inequity in what we're facing.
Thank you. And we understand that value exclusion is a problem for many school districts and other jurisdictions. So we're going to take a look at that also. Anything else? Thank you, Senator Sachs. Senate File 386 is laid on the table.
Senator Scoy is bold enough to bring us. What is it? Senate File 576. Senate File 576 is before us, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And for the discussion that we were just having about the disparity that the voter approved referendum is causing in our school districts and the divide that it causes in our community as they work to pass these, and the inequity in education, this bill started out as a larger effort to remove the first tier approved referendum. I was trying to find a way to not have that first $700 of the approved referendum go through the voter-approved process. In the end, I wasn't able to figure out a way to accomplish that goal, so I did go back and revisit some of the recommendations of the Governor's Education Task Force. And one of their recommendations was to take the bottom $300 off the approved referendum and replace it with a school board-approved levy. Now, they have a number of other recommendations in there dealing with this, in that they then were going to have other levy adjustments based on location of the school district or the regional nature of the school district. Now, I have not included those in this bill, but I think as this moves forward, that will also become part of our discussion. And so, Senate File 576 is an education advancement. It creates a $300 per resident margin municipal cost pupil unit levy, and it is going to be equalized. We are getting into the equalization discussion later on today, but I would ask for your support on this effort. I did make a change from the market value to the adjusted net tax capacity on this levy. And so really for a school district, there would be, from my perspective, no additional levy on the school district properties. It just might fall a little different depending upon whether the market value is a greater percentage of the net adjusted net tax capacity, which brings the classification rate into play. I think with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for questions. And I think there are a few people that wanted to testify. I didn't bring my...
Senator Skoy, we have Sam Walseth, Bill Dial, Kathleen Engblom, and Dennis Peterson is on the list. Senator Skoy, if they're here, they can come forward. Senator Skoy, I have a question that was raised to me about the whether this bill is in any way related to the literacy aid that is currently distributed among the school districts. This is not in any way a proposal that replaces that or has any relationship to that. Am I correct?
Yes, Madam
I said
Chair.
Not.
This would have nothing to do with literacy aid. This would not have anything to do with any of the other levies that the school districts levy. In the past, the Senate has made an effort to try to consolidate those levies into one. This does not do that. This is just the replacement for the bottom $300 of the voter-approved levy. That's all it is. And so the $300 will fall on somewhat different property taxpayers because of the change from market value to adjusted net tax capacity. But otherwise, I would expect the property tax burden within the school district to be very comparable.
And for some, that there, it would still be a levy and they wouldn't be getting any aid. Is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair, what we're going to do next is hear a bill dealing with equalizing. In my original plan, I was going to have a fully equalized levy on this, and it currently is in that form right now. As we get into the equalizing discussion, we're going to find that there are a few challenges with that I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
I think in the end for today, we will be laying this bill on the table for further work.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Sure. My name is Bill Dial. I live in East Central Minnesota. I'm a excuse me?
I just said Mr. Dial.
Okay. I live in the North Branch School District. My school district is now a four-day-a-week school district. We had to pull our kids out of the North Branch School District, unfortunately. We moved them to Cambridge. Our choice was, sort of a lesser of the two evils. North Branch has a great school district. The teachers are wonderful there. It's just we were looking at the future of my children. One of my children was going into kindergarten. She was only going to be able to attend kindergarten twice a week because of the four-day week. My other daughter was going into high school. She's a great student, AB student, but they shut down a lot of the programs that she was interested in, art programs, music programs, and the choice my wife and I had to make wasn't an easy one because we do support our community. We moved them to Cambridge. Now, Cambridge is having the same kind of problems. The whole corridor along the 95, East Central Minnesota area is having problems. This is affecting all of us. I know they're going to be talking about the equalization for school funding later today, but I just wanted to state that if we have any kind of equalization that's based on whether or not our areas pass levies, it's not going to benefit any of us. We haven't passed a levy in my area in 8 years. Cambridge is no different. Malacca is no different. Bram, Mora, Isle, the whole area. We're all suffering up there. Our state constitution, Article 13, states that we should have equal funding for all of our children. We're not having equal funding, or we're not having equal education for our children. We're having to make hard decisions up there. And I'm very concerned. I hope that we can come up with some way that the state can have dedicated funding like we do for transportation to help fund our schools, to make sure that our kids are taken care of, because this is our future. We don't know what this is going to do down the road. I know when my daughter graduates from Cambridge, she's going to go to college with students that had those kind of benefits, those kind of programs. I don't know if this is going to affect her negatively, but, you know, we don't know. This is an experiment that we're playing with our children, and our children are not political, and it needs to stop being a political football. And we really need to do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dial. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and Mr. Dial. I was omitted part of the discussion on this bill that would be the beneficial for your school district, and I focused in on the school districts that had a voter-approved referendum of more than $300. But any school district that does not have a voter-approved referendum or one that's under $300, it would actually be some new dollars flowing into those school districts based on the school board approval. I think Mr. Walseth
and Ms. Engblom and Mr. Peterson, are they here? Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Sam Walseth, Minnesota Rural Education Association. I'm back like a bad penny. What we're trying to do today is we're really trying to get the bottom up. All the legislation that you're reviewing today is about how do you get some of these low-income school districts to get some revenue into their school districts to provide programming for students. I think the average operating referendum today, and Dr. Melcher from the department can correct me on this, is about $1,000 per pupil. Senator Skoy's bill here is talking about getting $300 per pupil to the districts that are at zero. And we believe, I mean, that's 30% of the average, so this is not a big ask for what we're trying to get. But we're trying to get those districts who are at $0 or $1 on the referendum, trying to get them some basic revenue into those school districts. So as Mr. Dial testified, we can start moving away from four-day weeks and reducing electives and getting those students the opportunities they need.
Ms. Engblom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kathleen Engblom, and I work in food service in Mille Lacs Public School. My kids are already all through school, graduated, but I see kids every day that starting from kindergarten all the way up have kind of scratched and clawed their way up. When my youngest two kids were in school, the kindergarten class sizes were 16 pupils per class. Today, that is 30. And when I volunteered back when my kids were in kindergarten, I just was in awe and amazement of how the teachers could orchestrate 16 students with various levels of learning skills. So now I see kids falling through the cracks from kindergarten all the way up, if they make it all the way up. We've had cuts in many different things from the elementary level all the way up, such as Spanish classes, which would allow them to compete on a much higher level when they get up to the college level. So I just see these kids from kindergarten that, say, if they're maybe at a second grade level starting kindergarten, they're not allowed to accelerate their education. They just have to stay there. And then same with the kids that are maybe struggling when they begin the kindergarten, they don't get any special individualized learning programs. So it's a big challenge for everyone except for those few that are in the middle. And then the high school dropout rate. I see those kids that I used to volunteer with in third grade dropping out now that they're in high school because they've fallen through the cracks. And neighboring schools like Onama and Ogilvy have had to go to four-day school weeks. So these kids that are falling through the cracks, it just doesn't stop there. It affects our community, crime levels, the health, health levels. You know, these are things that we are going to have to pay for in our taxes because they fell through the cracks in the education department. The crime and the poverty affects all of us deeply, and we just need a fix for all the districts, not just, you know, the ones that are doing well. To keep them doing well, we need a fix for those of us that are in the outer circles of the education. Thank you for listening to me, and I'm sure you're very aware of the equity problem, but I hope we can fix it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Emblum. Next, I have Superintendent Peterson.
And Mr. Lundell would like to speak also, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Peterson? Superintendent? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Peterson, Superintendent of the Minnetonka School District, and I'm here to speak on Senate File 576. It's a bill that we're still studying in Minnetonka, but in general, we're concerned about the recommendation the task force made about rolling in dollars that are in existing levies. It was a bad idea in 2001. We think it's a bad idea yet. And so we're very concerned about that. Having spent a good deal of my life in rural schools, I also sympathize with the needs that have been expressed to you already this morning. And I think there are other ways to come at that. Maybe you just need to give boards of education in some of those districts that aren't able to support the education of their children more authority to set levies without affecting the rest of the districts that have already been able to pass referendums. I would argue that none of us in Minnesota school districts are getting too much money. What you're hearing now and what you've heard over the last several years is that things are getting desperate in a lot of districts. And I wouldn't portray to you at all that that's true in Minnetonka. We've really worked hard to use the dollars carefully that we have. And we spend about state average, maybe a little bit higher than state average. We do have a significant voter-approved referendum. But that's necessary because we don't get much money from the state. And so even with that referendum, we're not one of the higher spending districts or higher revenue districts. We need to really look at all sources of revenue when we're looking at equity in our state and not just sort out a few that we'd like to use for comparisons. And too often I think that happens with referendum money and maybe just basic state aid. So I would encourage that examination. I think another point that was made earlier by the senator was that the task force even looked at such things as location equity index, which means that we don't have equity in our system right now because we're not considering how costly it is for many of our districts to do business. And most of the referendum differences that exist in various parts of the state are due to that cost difference that we have to acknowledge at some point in our formula. And so I'd encourage that that be woven into this bill if it moves forward and give it more consideration. The other point I'd like to make is that as we look at taxes throughout the state of Minnesota, and I know the Department of Revenue has not updated their study that they've done periodically over the years, but the most recent study they have shows that on the same property in the metro area and outstate, the metro taxpayer pays a lot more tax. And so, you know, this appears to have some potential of even exacerbating that differential in the future. The other aspect of the bill is the freeze of the referendum revenue in 2015. We prefer to let that be affected by existing legislation and move forward. And I guess the other point, and I know that you're aware of this, but there are several bills dealing with this whole issue of what pupil units we're counting, how we calculate referendum aid and so, or referendum dollars and so forth. So I would remind you that with some of those out there yet, there, maybe there needs to be an effort to kind of put all the ideas together so we know what we're really looking at. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could ask the superintendent a question, I understand your issue with regard to the location aid, and I think at some point that debate will occur. I was curious as to what exactly the objection is to replacing the voter-approved with a school board-approved levy. I didn't catch what exactly the objection to that was.
Well, I think the objection is the broad nature of the provision is that it's not just districts that now have that levy in place, but all districts. So it's the way it gets treated in that formula, and the fact that we may actually have our taxpayers paying a larger tax than they are now for that same dollar.
Madam Chair, Superintendent, I'm here to assure you that your taxpayers will not be paying any more taxes than they would before under this bill. There's no way that any tax dollars would flow from your school district to any other school district. Those lines are drawn rigid, and it wouldn't be an impact that way. The tax burden within any school district, if they currently have a $300 voter-approved referendum or more, would be the same. It might fall somewhat on different property taxpayers because of the change from market value to net tax capacity.
Correct. Thank you.
Superintendent, did you have anything further?
No, I don't.
Mr. Lundell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell. I neglected to sign up to testify in favor of this bill, and I am appreciative of the committee's indulgence for allowing me to give some brief comments. Schools for Equity in Education contains many of the members or the districts that were up here with SEIU 284. Mille Lacs, Cambridge at Sandy, North Branch, Ogilvie, all our districts that have no referendum. Brame has a small referendum. Mora has a small referendum. There are about 40 districts in the state that are at zero in terms of referendum right now, and another collection that's below 300. I don't think there's any question that the state support, as Senator Bach has pointed out, has lagged over the last two decades and has lagged for a variety of reasons, causing greater reliance on the referendum. And, you know, some districts just are not able to pass referenda, as we've seen in a number of districts. This would address that. This is a twist on one of the governor's recommendations of the governor's working group on education finance that has worked over the last 2 years. This one kind of fell out as we moved from Roseville to the governor's mansion. It was very, very unfortunate, and I think it's something that really does need to be discussed as we move forward this year. A lot of these bills work together and work together nicely. But I think one of the things we do need to look at are those districts that, as has been pointed out, you can give them probably 95 cents on the dollar in terms of equalization, but the voters there really love that nickel for some reason or another. And I think that that's one of the things that we really need to address, and having a general education formula that it more closely addresses the true needs of school districts throughout the state and reduces reliance on the referendum and at the same time makes the referendum more fair, I believe, is an approach that should be taken, and I'm very hopeful that this committee, and along with the Education Committee, will seriously deliberate on these proposals. And I'll be sucking more air out of the room later. So,
thank you, Mr. Lundell. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate File 576? Senator Skoy, this chart here, is this a chart that represents Senate File 576, or is a combination, or is this for your bill? I don't see an attribution here.
Madam Chair, I don't have a copy of that. I don't know what you're
looking
at.
It's in our packets.
Right, I don't have it.
What's the source of this?
I don't know what you're looking at. I don't have a copy.
It's not in my packet, Madam Chair.
Oh, I have it. I guess it wasn't It wasn't distributed, but it's a document that talks about the educational advancement revenue plus the revenue equalization modeling and, you know, have current law plus the change. And I thought maybe it was representing your bill, but I guess not.
Madam Chair, if I could look at it, I could tell you if it's anything that I've been working on, but I can't from here.
Okay. Just set it aside then, because I don't understand it, I guess. So I thought maybe you could let us know. Anyone else to testify on 576? Then we'll lay over 576 at this time and take up Senate File 177. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Senator Hoffman here? He also has...
Right behind you.
I wonder if he could join me at the table.
Sure. Senator Hoffman, welcome to the committee. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Senator Hoffman and I have been working on a variety of initiatives trying to re-energize the equalizing formula that is occurring in that Minnesota currently has. The equalizing formula is an effort that the state has going back to the Minnesota miracle to equalize the tax burden on property taxpayers across the state so that they would have a comparable burden on funding their schools, not counting where they are within the state, so that if you have a $100,000 home in Higley or a $100,000 home in Burnsville, the tax burden for education should be comparable. Now, the equalizing formula that we have for a couple of our school levies has not been adjusted since the early 1990s. And for most of us, we understand that in the intervening 20-some years, property values have probably more than doubled. That has saved the state a significant amount of money in equalizing dollars, but it also has passed that burden on to our property taxpayers. So as we have, Senator Hoffman and I have been discussing this, we think that the previous bill that we just heard will work well if we're able to figure out a way to increase the equalizing dollars on these levies. And so, you know, we could have just proposed to equalize just the voter-approved referendum levies, but as we heard in testimony, a number of school districts don't even have those levies passed, so it wouldn't be a benefit to them. So we thought that we should establish another levy mechanism, which was in Senate File 576, and then with Senate File 177 or 569, we would come along with a mechanism that would then equalize those levy dollars. Now, there has been proposals in the past to consolidate current levies and equalize those. There is a perception, I believe, that that is not a good mechanism to use, so we're also not going down that road. So we do have the 576, which is a new school board approved levy, and it replaces the bottom off the voter approved. And now with these two bills, Senate File 177, we would be proposing a significant increase in equalizing on those dollars. I think with that, I will turn it over to Senator Hoffman for a few comments. And then what I was hoping, Madam Chair, is that Dr. Melcher from the Department of Education could just give a little walkthrough of the history of equalizing in Minnesota, help the committee understand some of the issues. As we're gathering through this discussion today, this is a relatively complicated area. It impacts all Minnesotans. They all live in a school district. And so it's an important discussion to have today, and I hope that
Senator Skoy, would it be more helpful to have Mr. Melcher come up now before we hear of how Senator Hoffman's bill works?
Sure. That'd be
okay.
Great.
And members, we have in the packets a document, I think this is what he'll be talking to, from the MDE about Minnesota School District Levy Equalization is what the title of it is. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the State Department of Education. I'd like to just briefly walk through the purpose, history, and mechanics of equalization.
Thank you.
Three reasons why we have equalization in the state. The first is the constitutional requirement to provide a uniform system of public education. The second one is shown in the chart at the bottom of the page. The state has chosen to rely on school property tax levies to provide for a portion of that system of education. And in the last 10 years, the property tax share of education funding has grown from 12% to 20% of the total school revenue. Turn to the second page of the handout. The third reason why we need school levy equalization is that we do have wide differences among school districts in tax base. We use two tax bases for school levies. Most school levies, including debt service levies, are based on the school district's adjusted net tax capacity per pupil unit. If we take all the school districts in the state and we divide them into deciles, so one-tenth of the students in the bottom decile, one-tenth in the top decile, we have about a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of adjusted net tax capacity per student. So without equalization, the lowest one-tenth of the school districts would have a tax rate 4 times as high as the highest 10% of the school districts in terms of tax base per student. The second tax base we use for school levies is the referendum market value. We use that for referendum levies, but also for school equity levies and for transition levies. And again, there we have a 3.7-to-1 ratio in terms of the tax base per student between the bottom 10% of the districts and the top 10% of the districts. So again, in the absence of equalization, school districts at the top end would have a levy 1/4 the rate of school districts at the bottom end to raise the same amount of money per student. Turn to page 3 of the document. There is a brief summary of the history of equalization in our state. We've been doing levy equalization for schools for about 100 years, going back to 1915. The modern era for equalization for schools started in 1957 when we created the foundation program, which is now called the general education program. What that program does is establishes a basic amount of funding per student, and it also establishes a uniform local tax rate so that all school districts in the state would levy the same tax rate per student in order to generate the basic general education formula. We used that system from 1957 until 2001 when the state eliminated the uniform general education levy. In 1971, with the Minnesota Miracle, we substantially increased state aid for schools by increasing state income and sales taxes, reducing property tax levies. That was the year when we initiated statewide levy limits on school districts and created the requirement for school districts to go to the voters in a referendum levy to exceed that limit. In 1991, the state began to equalize referendum levies. That was also the year when referendum levies were converted from a tax rate to a dollar amount per pupil on the ballot. It was also the year when we changed from using the tax capacity to market value for spreading those levies. And there was also a cap established on referendum revenue per student. Service equalization was also passed by the legislature in 1991. It was initially vetoed by Governor Carlson. The legislature came back in 1992 and established the debt service equalization program that we currently have. The next significant change in the equalization occurred in 2001 when the legislature eliminated the general education levy, fully funded the formula allowance through state aid. At that time, the legislature also reduced the referendums by $415 per pupil and moved that money into the general education formula. 2001 was also the year when the ag land and cabin property were taken off of the referendum levy and moved to the statewide levy. There also have been changes in the caps. In 2005, the referendum cap was expanded from 18.6% to 26%. That allowed districts at the high end of the revenue range to generate larger referendum levies, increased the gap in referendum funding among school districts. And then the most recent significant change in referendums was in 2006, where school districts are now allowed to have an inflation adjustment on their referendum ballot questions. So how do we do equalization? There are really kind of three approaches
Melcher,
here.
How does that work? What is the how does the ballot question how is the ballot question stated so that voters know that taxpayers know that there is going to be an inflation adjustment during the life of the referendum levy?
Madam Chair, Representative Rest, the ballot language in Minnesota Statute 126C17 specifies that the district will state specifically that the school district is approving X number of dollars per student the first year, and that will be annually adjusted based on the consumer price index.
And that is part of the question?
That is part of the question. Okay.
And it's for the life of the referendum that it's annually adjusted?
That it's annually adjusted.
By the CPI.
Referendums can be up to 10 years, and the number of years is also specified on the ballot. Some school districts have chosen to include that inflationary adjustment. Some have not. So it's not mandatory. It's up to the school district to decide.
It's just, Mr. Melcher, if they want to have an inflation adjustment, it has to be stated in the question. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So the mechanics that have been used to do levy equalization, there are really two approaches. One is the uniform levy approach, which we used from 1957 and 2000 until 2001 for the general education program. We currently still use that for community education and early childhood levies, and there you have a stated dollar amount or a stated tax rate in state law, and all school districts levy the same tax rate, and their state aid is the difference between an allowance per student and the amount that's raised in the district through that tax rate. Now, the second approach for equalization is called an equalizing factor approach, and what the state does there is to guarantee a certain tax base level. And that's the approach we use for referendum equalization and debt service equalization. So state law will define a guaranteed tax base per student. If the school district's tax base is less than that guarantee, then the state provides equalization aid to fill in the difference. And then we have another category of unequalized levies. We have several levies that are still completely local property tax, and those include the Safe Schools levy, the Building Lease levy, the OPEB levy, alternative facilities levies, the integration levy, the 30% that's local, unemployment insurance, and some other smaller levies. So that's kind of our...
The unequalized levies, Mr. Melcher, they're all discretionary. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, they are all discretionary. So on page 5 of the handout, we have a brief review of the operating referendum equalization. We have a two-tiered equalizing formula. The first $700 per student, we guarantee a tax base of $476,000 per student. That $476,000 has been on the books since the late 90s, so we've not had any inflationary adjustment in that over time. We also have Tier 2 equalization, which covers the portion of referendums between $700 per student and 26% of the general ed formula, which is currently $1,358 per student. Now, the equalizing factor for that is lower at $270,000. And then we also have referendum tax base replacement aid, which was intended to offset the loss of the ag land and seasonal recreational cabin property. It's basically a minimum guarantee that a school district's referendum aid will always be at least as great as the amount of referendum levy that was paid by ag land and cabin property back in 2001. So what's been the history of referendums? The chart.
Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher, so this referendum tax base, that takes what was in the seasonal recreational and ag lands that the school districts were levying on and guarantees that their current referendum aid would equal what they had in 2001 for seasonal rec and ag land levies.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, yes, but it's the portion that was paid by those two types of properties over and above the $415 per pupil that was rolled out.
Over 415. Okay, thank you.
So the history of referendum levies, as you can see from the chart in the middle of page 5, is that we've had a substantial increase since 1986 from less than $100 million to almost $900 million. The state aid portion is in the light gray area. You can see that most of the referendum revenue is coming from the property tax. The percentage of referendum revenue that comes from state aid is on the lower portion. Historically, the referendum equalization was designed to cover about a third of the cost of referendums. but since about 2002, that has slipped down to about 12%.
Mr. Melshin, what's the explanation of the that severe drop in what looks like 2003? What happened then? And then it seems to go back up, but the taxes are astronomical.
Madam Chair, what happened in 2003 was the roll-in of the $415 per pupil, and the state has the higher level of equalization on the first portion of the referendum. And so the bottom line is that when the $415 got rolled in, that eliminated most of the equalization aid along with the levy portion.
I see. And then it started building up again.
And as you can see, we reached a low of 8% in 2011. We've had a little bit of growth in equalization aid because of the decline in home values since then.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, while you're looking at that graph, the Superintendent Peterson from Minnetonka commented on the fact that we were freezing the referendum levies for 1 year. And what happened when they rolled in the 415, there's been some discussion about the impact that happened and how school mm-hmm. districts went out and just levied that additional $415. And so the initiative that I had in that earlier bill was to go at least 1 year to let that line level out and see if we didn't have that significant increase occurring in the future if we do something comparable to what the 415 roll-in was. Does that make sense? I just wanted to mention that. I have concerns about that graph line also.
Yep. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, on that point, in 2003, that was the year that the 2001 changes took effect, and we not only eliminated $415 of referendum levy, but also close to $1 billion of general education levy. It basically cut the school levy in half, and that created an opportunity for school districts to go and ask for an increase in referendums and still be able to say that property taxes were going down compared to the prior year. Madam Chair, on page 6, the top of the page, we have a chart that shows the percentage of students in districts that are off the formula, in other words, that would not qualify for any referendum equalization aid. Now, the system was originally designed so that most districts were on the formula. At the time that the $476,000 was put into law, that was Edina's tax base per student. So essentially every district in the state, with a handful of exceptions, did qualify for equalization aid. By 2011, 51% of the students were in districts that did not qualify for any equalization aid because of the growth in tax base and no growth in the equalization. Since 2011, that's gone down a little bit because of declining property values, but we expect that will go back up again as the housing market rebounds. The chart at the bottom of page 6 is showing the tax rate needed to raise $1,000 per pupil on $100,000 of referendum market value. And over on the left-hand side, you see a school district, for example, with $100,000 of referendum market value per pupil. The tax on $100,000 of market value would be $258 annually to raise that $1,000 per pupil. And the state equalization formula guarantees that $258 remains flat as long as you're on the formula. And what you see is that districts off the formula, as their tax base increases, by the time you get to a tax base of $700,000, the annual tax would be $143. By the time you get to 1.3 million, which is the level that many of our western suburbs are at, you're down to $77. So you can see the differential depending on where you are in the state in terms of the tax on $100,000 of market value to raise that $1,000 per pupil. And I picked $1,000 per pupil here because our average right now is $1,035 per pupil on the referendum. Moving to debt equalization, Madam Chair and members, on page 7, you can see the long-term history of that. We've gone from roughly $180 million of debt service up to about $750,000 of debt service. The debt service funding formula is structured in three tiers. We have an unequalized tier, which is currently equal to 15% of the adjusted net tax capacity. So when you go out and pass a bond issue, the tax rate up to 15.74% is not equalized by the state. Then we have a relatively low equalizing factor for the levy between 15% and 26%. And then we have a much higher equalizing factor for the levy over 26%. You can see the amount of revenue there in each of those three tiers. The chart on the bottom of page 7 is showing the percentage of students in districts off the formula for the first tier. So this was originally designed so that about half of the districts, once they got to a 15% tax rate, would get some equalization aid on their debt service. But over time, because we have not adjusted for inflation, we're now at the level where 96% of all of the students are in districts that don't qualify for any equalization in tier one. So they'd actually have to get to a 26% tax rate for debt service and get into tier two before there would be any equalization aid from the state. The chart on the top of page 8 is showing the state share for those districts that are receiving equalization aid. So originally, for districts that were in Tier 1, they were getting roughly 46% state aid, and that's dropped down to 0.4% because nearly everybody is off the formula. In Tier 2, the current rate is about 48%. So if a district does get to a relatively high tax rate for debt service, over 26% of adjusted net tax capacity, then there still is substantial equalization for those districts.
Where are those districts located?
Madam Chair, the districts that would be in Tier 2 typically would be districts that have had to do a major building project that have relatively low tax base. It could be a small rural district that's had to replace a school, or it could be an outer ring suburb.
Or a growing growing district like Southwest Metro, Southwest Metro like Chaska and Chanhassen.
It could be in that situation, yes. Right. They have to have relatively low tax base per student and high needs for debt service.
Right. Senator Skoy?
Madam Chair, I know of one school district, Kellyer, that is in this Tier 2 category. But the question I had...
To handle increasing enrollment or to replace a substandard building?
It was a substandard building. They replaced a substandard building with a new building, and they did qualify for the Tier 2 equalization. The question I have for Dr. Melcher, and this is what comes up to me as I talk to people who represent the school districts that this is impacting, is when they went to their voters, they were at one equalizing level so that the local effort was X. Now the local effort is X times 2. And the voters kind of feel like the state hasn't with what it said it was going to do for equalizing. I'm wondering if Dr. Melcher has any comments on that, how large of a problem he thinks that might be.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, I would say that I have heard a lot of those same types of comments where debt service levies for school districts typically run 20-year bond issues, and quite often the school district goes to the voters saying the state share is going to be X percent, and then 2 years later the state share is half of what it was due to changes in the tax base of the school district. So it has been a long-term problem for us, and you can see from chart on the top of page 8 there, if you were in Tier 1, for example, and you were getting 46% in 1994, and if your bond issue had lasted 20 years, by the time you got to the end of it, you had been getting 0%. See,
right.
So that's the typical sort of situation you'd be seeing.
Could I ask?
So why is it going back up in Tier 2?
Madam Chair, I think that's the same thing that's happening with referendum equalization, that we've had a decline in tax base per student because of lowered home values.
Yes, okay. And so that's a reflection going back up, not of any state policy change, but simply in the housing market is recovering. Is that?
Madam Chair, yes. The equalization factor has been constant. So in those years when the property values have been going up, the state share has gone down, and then in recent years it's gone up because of the decline in value. But I expect it to go back the other way once the housing market recovers.
Senator Corey.
Thank you. And Dr. Melcher, could you talk to me just a little bit, how does the school districts, I think there's 19 or 21 of them around the state that are in the maximum effort loan program. Does that impact this? And isn't the bonds for those school districts, aren't they 50-year bonds?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, for the more recent maximum effort loan districts, it is a 50-year schedule, and they pay a fixed tax rate. And so when we provide debt equalization, what happens is that allows them to pay off their loans more quickly. They still have to levy that that tax rate that's specified in law, but then the district actually raises more revenue than what their cost of the principal and interest would be, and so that's supposed to go back to the state. Now, some of them have then turned around and issued what we call one-day bonds, where they do additional projects. That kind of slows down the repayment, but theoretically, additional debt equalization would speed up the repayment for those schools.
And, Madam Chair, the point, the other point that I wanted to make was that there are 50-year bonds that mm-hmm. school districts are signing up for, which is a huge time frame for this kind of stuff.
Dr. Milton.
Madam Chair and members, the chart on the bottom of page 8 is showing the history of debt service. The black is the levy portion. The gray is the aid. As you can see, nearly all of this is coming from local property tax. That's borne out a little bit more more on the table on the top of page 9, which shows that historically the debt equalization formula was designed to cover about 11% of debt levy. This initial increase was a three-year phase-in. So we were covering 11% of the levy, and then as a result of inflation and no change in the equalization, we're down to 2.5%. So most districts don't get an equalization.
And that slight upward trend, again, is because of the recovery of the housing market. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. That's because of the decline in the housing
change,
market.
Yes.
And the little bubble in 2003 is we added Tier 2. We didn't used to have a Tier 2. And then at the bottom of page 9, I have a list of other levies that are equalized by the state. These tend to use equalizing factors, and so and I compare 2003 and 2014. So in 2003, when the state eliminated the general education levy, we were also covering 100% of the operating capital levy and the equity for school districts. Since then, as part of the strategy to address the state budget shortfall, we've required school districts to levy for part of that. Mm-hmm. So we've gone down to 43% of the operating capital and 23% of the equity. We've also added the QCOMP levy. We're covering about 8% of the QCOMP levy through state aid. And then in health and safety, you can see...
Excuse me. And those are requirements that the state has imposed on the school districts with regard to how much they have to levy for the operating capital.
Madam Chair, the levy is technically optional, but what it provides is about $200 per student for the maintenance costs of the school district. So if they want to replace their roofs and carpet mm-hmm. and other things that wear out, they have to make this levy. So it's not technically mandatory, but the school districts can't get by without it.
If they choose to do that, they have to use the formula that the state sets up.
Yes,
okay.
Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Dr. Mister, how many school districts, are there any school districts that do not levy that?
Madam Chair, I believe all school districts levy the operating capital levy. In the case of QCOMP, they're significantly less than all of the districts. That becomes more of a choice. Yeah. And then down below, you'll see in the area of health and safety, the state used to provide significantly more equalization than it does now. We're down to about 1%. Of the health and safety that pays for things like indoor air quality, asbestos problems, that sort of thing in schools. Deferred maintenance, we're paying 14% in state aid. Community education, we're down to 2%, so 98% of the community ed cost is covered by a local levy. In early childhood family education, that one's been more stable. Mm-hmm. We're still covering 50%, and that's because we have a uniform tax rate and we specify the dollar amount of the levy in statute, so it's not tied to the growth in the property value. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my review of the history of equalization in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments for Mr. Melcher? Senator Chamberlain.
General comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Skoy, Senator Hoffman. We agree. Thank you for doing this. It is very much needed to address this issue. My personal feeling and philosophy is that the state needs to obviously take a big role in funding schools, but there should be some local accountability, some local money going into those schools, so there's some accountability locally, whether it's 15% or 20%. We can talk about that, but this certainly goes a long way to address some of these problems that have been around for a long time. So thank you for doing this. And the costs here, I hope that we can find a way to negotiate with the governor and some others to, you know, make sure that we can get the numbers to work for us. These are big numbers, but I think we can scale it and do some other things. So it's a great step. Thank you very much.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't see a fiscal note for this bill, and so I've asked, and it's going to be distributed. I think that's a really big piece of what we're going to do here.
Of the hearing, Senator Ortman, I asked for the runs on all of these bills so that we can understand the relationship among them. I agree with you that we need to really get a handle on how these various bills, if they were adopted, how they interact with one another as well.
Right.
And I think that would be good information as we go forward. And I Senator Skoy said he was interested in that too. Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, we're going to lay these on the table today for additional work, and I was planning on talking about some of the costs. That's my comment. So we will get to that at some point.
Well, Madam Chair.
And Senator Ortman, I understand we do have a fiscal note for Senator Hoffman's bill, but not for the other.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I think they're being handed out now, which is
a good thing. The fiscal note is a little bit different than seeing a property tax run, though, which I'm also very interested in.
Madam Chair, I think both are very important to this conversation. This would have statewide impact everywhere. And what I'm trying to understand is, maybe Senator Skoy, you can tell me whether this is intended, or Senator Hoffman, whether the intent here is that if a school district passes a referendum, they also get additional funds from the state. Is there an incentive to pass that referendum? Is there a financial benefit to doing that?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, the bill that I have on the levies deals with taking $300 off the voter-approved levy and replacing it with a school board-approved levy that's on net tax capacity instead of market value. Then we proposing to freeze the voter-approved levy for 1 year so that that can take effect before the school district would be allowed to go back for another voter-approved referendum. So it's a change in funding, not an increase or a decrease in funding.
All right. Thank you.
At this point, why don't we hear from Senator Hoffman or Senator Skoy?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator
Whatever you'd like.
Senator Ortman, to the point about that, I should clarify that if we put the equalizing bill into the levy bill, then there could potentially be an increase in state aid, and so it would be a change at that point. But the original bill as drafted did not.
All right. I think, Madam Chair, Senator we just Ortman. Have an awful lot to learn about this and to consider. And I appreciate Senator Skoy and Senator Hoffman's you're willing to move forward with this to have the discussion. But a change like this will have huge unintended consequences, is what I fear. And so we should make sure we know as many of them as possible.
Well, Senator Ortman, you know what I think is the most valuable thing here is that Senator Skoy and Senator Hoffman, Senator Saxhog have brought these issues to the tax committee. And rather than seeing them for the first time when the K-12 bill comes before the tax committee. So, you know, we have a, you know, kind of a first slice at this is really trying to understand how this brings about brings about within the property tax system itself property tax relief, I think, is one of the goals,
Absolutely.
As well as it's never going to be simple, but a proposal that says this is a better way of going about getting dollars into the schools and that the schools should care. The school district should care where the money comes from. It's not just a matter of throwing more money, I shouldn't say throw, of investing more money in school districts, but that it's done in a way that we could all embrace. Senator Skoy?
Madam Chair, and to the members, absolutely, this is a property tax issue. It impacts school funding, but the primary core, it's property. And when you listen to what Dr. Melcher was saying in his presentation, you can see the impact heard in the last 10 years on property taxes because of the way the state rules. It's time that we have a real good discussion about it. I do want to say with regard to unintended consequences, we do kind of have a model to look at. If we look at the 415 roll-in that occurred earlier, that is a comparable mechanism. That was state aid, and that could be something that we should be contemplating as we go forward with this.
Senator Orman?
I'm sorry. I was just going to say we actually spent quite a bit of time on this last year in the tax committee because we recognized that this is a tax issue. And if the funding from the schools isn't coming from local property taxes, it's then being funded with income and sales tax revenues that come into the state of Minnesota. I mean, I think it's perfectly appropriate to have this conversation in the tax committee. And I also appreciate the work that's being done here. I think we need to have the conversation, and we need to balance the interests. How much should the state be paying to fund schools? How much should the local property tax burden be? And what do we do about the fact that it's a lot easier to raise those local property taxes in some communities rather than in others? And I represent communities on the full range of these communities. And I think we all are very interested in what happens here and how we make sure it's done properly, transparently, and fairly. And so I appreciate that, too.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Senator Hoffman, do you want to just take us through your bill, unless Senator Scoy?
Madam Chair, I think we were going to have Mr. Lundell speak, and then...
Okay, Mr. Lundell, you're speaking now on Senate File 177.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. And the witnesses I brought from districts were also to speak to 177, but because of the similarity to 569, I don't really care about the order, and if it's up to the committee whether the people that are speaking on behalf of C would speak after me or speak after Senator Hoffman's presentation.
Why don't you just go ahead since you're sitting there?
Again, as Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education, and our organization kind of lives at the intersection of property tax policy and education finance policy. It's kind of the center where we're at. We're the low property wealth districts throughout the state that have had, as Senator Ortman just pointed out, more difficulty passing referenda because of differential property values or lower property values. And when equalization policy does not keep up with inflation or property wealth growth, we find ourselves at a disadvantage. There's a couple of handouts I have, and I wish I had talked to Dr. Melcher because I could have saved some printing costs because Dr. Melcher has certainly covered much of this. I do have something a little bit different than his in talking about the Pay 13 referendum levies and how per $100,000 of value, how that differs from district to district. One of the things, and I think, Madam Chair, you kind of pointed it out, one of the things that we're kind of like the old CERTS commercial, only it's like people say equalization's property tax policy, no, it's education funding policy, no, it's property tax policy, no, it's education funding policy. And so we've kind of been two issues that has had a hard time finding a home. And a lot of that has to...
Excuse me, Mr. Lundell, just a moment. The page is passing out these sheets of paper. Who are they coming from?
That is not from our organization. Oh, wait.
Senator Thompson, is this from you?
Madam Chair.
No, it is not.
Oh, Madam this Chair. Is from you. Your name wasn't on it, so we didn't know where it was coming from. Okay.
No, my three say referendum history, statewide referendum market value growth, it's a bar chart, and then this table of seven pages that's referendum per pupil unit, and then the burden per $100,000 of value. I think that, you know, it's instructive, though, that, you know, we're finding a home this year, and I think it is appropriate that this start in the tax committee. This is clearly property tax policy. Going back to the late 1960s, the Minnesota miracle that was created in 1971 was as much or more about differential property tax issues than as it was about education funding. That's when the general education levy was first created. Massive amounts of money, state revenue into local property taxes, because back then school boards basically set the amount of levy they were going to get. The state aid came out as a, you know, X amount per pupil. And so there really was a system that was really property tax intensive, and as a result, great disparity in terms of opportunity was available to students throughout the state. We support both of these approaches. I think Senator Scoy's is obviously a larger bite of the apple. We think it's very, very appropriate to go to the level that Senator Scoy is talking about. property tax has more than doubled. And when you take into account that the referendum market value tax base does not include the seasonal recreational property, which is growing, does no longer creates the agricultural property, which is growing rapidly right now. Some of the tax base in that area grows rapidly. So I think that doubling the equalizing factor is clearly warranted and clearly something that we need to talk about. Whether we can get to that level is another question. Resource availability of resources certainly is going to dictate that. But we certainly want to talk about this and talk about this very aggressively. I think to Senator Bach's point on an earlier bill, though, it would be wonderful if we lived in a world where we could really reduce the reliance on referenda. And how you do that is Senator Skoy's earlier bill, but also look at the list of categorical revenue. I don't represent Superintendent Peterson, but I believe Superintendent Peterson is correct that that district does not get a lot of state money outside the basic formula. So if the basic formula does not keep pace with inflation, is not sufficient, he's going to ride the best horse in the stable, and that's going to be his referendum levy. And I think we have to get away from looking at referenda because it's, number one, it's random, and number two, it's unequalized. I think what Senator Skoy is doing here, that said, it's always going to be part of the system. It needs to be a fair part of the system. And what Senator Skoy is doing is moving forward in a very aggressive way to address growing inequities. And with that, again, how you want to handle witnesses is certainly up to you.
Just members, and Senator Skoy, we now have the fiscal note on it's being handed out on your bill, too. I think we want to hear from Senator Hoffman.
Thank you.
But I think members also at some point would like the fiscal notes explained, but I don't know that we'll have the time to do that and hear from the other witnesses. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be in front of you talking about Senate File 569. And I do have, I want to give before we start the discussion, two amendments I handed out, the author amendments, if it would be a pleasure
Senator,
to add those added.
Senator Hoffman, I don't have any amendments. Which amendments, Senator Hoffman?
It's Amendment 1, page 1, delete Section 1, and then...
What's the number at the top? It's the A1 amendment?
It would be A1, and the A1 amendment is that one, and then A2 amendment then reinserts language and cleans it up from 15.74 to 10% times the adjusted net tax capacity.
We have from Senator Hoffman the A1 amendment, which... delete Section 1 of the bill. All those in favor, it's an author's amendment. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment to 569 is adopted. And also the A2 amendment. Do members have that? On that first amendment, Senator Eaton, let's go back on that because we didn't have a proper motion. Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Eaton moves the A2 amendment. Another author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill now is before us as amended. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Senate File 569 really provides equity to the property taxpayers in school districts with low property wealth. It's kind of been the theme this morning, and I want to thank Senator Skoy for taking a lead in this and Senator Saxhog for also providing with the same comparative discussions regarding equity. And so what this one is, this equalization formula, the referendum debt service transition and equity levels, and I'm going to be brief. I'm bringing this forward because I believe a child in a low property wealth district should have access to equal educational opportunities as a student in a high property wealth district. And I agree, Senator Chamberlain, thank you. This is long overdue and for the discussion. So having said that, Madam Chair, with me today, you're going to hear from Tom Heidemann, who's the chair of the Anoka-Hennepin School District, Chris Richardson, who's the superintendent of schools of Northfield. Mr. Richardson was also the superintendent of schools in Osceola School District, and he and I both served on Congressman Ramstead's Education Advisory Committee at the time, and these issues go back, when even Dr. Richardson was part of Osceola. And then finally, you're going to hear from Denise Dietrich, who was on the Anoka-Hennepin School Board prior to me being on the Anoka-Hennepin School Board, and then she served as a House member for 10 years, and now is with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I'll give you, Denise Dietrich and Tom Heidemann probably forget more in a day on equalization than I'll ever learn, and so I'm glad to have them here with their perspective. But also I wanted to point out that our budget Director of Finance, Michelle Vargas, is here, as well as Associate Superintendent Jeff McGonigal, and then three other school board members that have taken time from their day to be here as well, Jeff Simon, Marcy Anderson, and Bill Harvey, along with Superintendent Denny Carlson. So with that, Madam Chair, I would like to bring up...
I have on the witness list Paul Carlson. If you'd come forward, please. And maybe with him, Nancy, I can't pronounce the last name. What is the last
Rajanin.
Name? Rajanin.
Yep.
And Tom, well, we'll just do with those two and take them two at a time. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Paul Carlson, Superintendent, New London Spicer Schools. I want to... again, echo some of the comments that have been made already, and thank the committee for addressing something in terms of equalization that needs to be, the factors need to be updated. And I want to thank the committee for hearing this. Specifically for New London and Spicer, New London and Spicer is approximately 110 miles west of the Twin Cities. And we have been off equalization since 2008. Back in 1997 and 2003, we were able to let our taxpayers know and inform our taxpayers if we were to pass an operating levy, the state would contribute a portion of that revenue so that it would be less tax burden to our small businesses and property owners. For New London and Spicer, we live in an area that is an area that does not have a lot of industry. Major industry. Our district is composed of property tax owners and small businesses. The largest employer in our district is the school district. So there is quite a burden on our taxpayers when we pass operating levies. And now in 2008, when we renewed and slightly increased our operating levy, we informed the voters that 100% of the operating levy would be on the property tax payers and no state aid. So we're off the formula, and encourage the committee to support these adjustments made to the equalization levy that is long overdue. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any comments or questions for Superintendent Carlson? Ms. Rajanin, Superintendent? You could identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Story and Senator Hoffman. My name is Nancy Rajan. I'm the Superintendent of Schools in Waconia, and I am speaking in support of both 177 and 569, the bills supporting equalization. For me, as the superintendent in the District of Waconia here, I find that these measures would significantly increase the equalization to bring down the cost of the levy dollars for taxpayers in low property districts. Waconia would not be considered a poor district by any stretch of the imagination. It's a lovely community and with fairly high resident income. However, we have no commercial and industrial. Our district borders Minnetonka. As a matter of fact, our district has a portion of Minnetonka in our district. We border other districts that have significant different opportunities and impact on our taxpayers when we go out for an operating levy. For example, on a $1,600 per pupil levy, students about 15 miles away in the Hopkins district, or the residents there, would pay about $153 per $100,000 of their home values, while the residents in my district would pay $366. That's twice the cost for my taxpayers there, and it simply provides unequal opportunities for my students. In my mind, this is an issue of fairness for our students. It's an issue of fairness for our taxpayers here. The intent of the equalization aid has always been to make sure that the cost of a school levy dollar is uniform across the state so that districts have the same ability to raise the student levy revenue for their students. The factor hasn't been adjusted since 1993, and I sincerely believe that the time is now to do that. I do have two members of my school board here, Naomi Erickson, and if it would be possible just for a moment for me to let them, sure. One of them, just comment on the differences and opportunities, I would appreciate that. And we also did bring some handouts, if we could provide those to a page.
Excuse me, to whom did you give the handouts?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank
Welcome
you.
Welcome to the committee, if you did not identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Members of the committee, I'm Kathy Thome. I come wearing actually many hats. I'm a parent. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a school board director in Waconia. I'm also on the C Executive Board and their legislative committee. So I've been aware of this issue since about 2004, a couple of years after the changes were made and the general education property tax levy was eliminated, and I have been involved and chaired two operating levies for my district since then. So this is an issue that I've been involved with for a long time. A 20-year lag on updating is actually ridiculous. If you're going to have a system that of equalization and you're going to stick to it, to not update it in 20 years is like not updating your wardrobe in 20 years. It's like not updating your household budget in 20 years. It's very impactive, and it just makes no sense. So it's either, if you're going to keep this system, you need to update it or get rid of it and find something else.
Excuse me, somebody needs to turn their phone off. Just wait. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And
just a second. Now, please respect that. It's very distracting to have that interference.
Madam Chair, just a
Senator Reinert.
It's a reminder to folks that your phone or your iPad, if it's getting cellular service, anywhere near a microphone. So.
Thank you, Senator Reinert. Go ahead.
Madam Chair. And so I'd just like to talk about some of the things that, even as a fairly high income district, but we are high income, but we are low property wealth. Our two largest employers in our community are Ridgeview Medical Center, which is a nonprofit, and our school district, which is a nonprofit as well. So,
how large is the school district pupils?
Per pupils, last count in our last board meeting was 3,562 students, and we have about 11,000 registered voters in our district. So, the types of programs that we would like to offer, but we really can't, and we lose districts to or students to open enrollment to districts east and northeast of us because of, is like college in the schools, international baccalaureate, an increase in our world languages and taking those down to the elementary level so that our students can learn them much, much younger, or an orchestra program. Our community has shown great interest in doing that. We'd also like to increase our specialist staff for remedial and acceleration in all subjects, but they're just very hard to find. It's very expensive. It's not in the budget. We've made some huge technology initiatives, but we need more money for staff development to train them in best practices for that. And the integration of technology and curriculum is so intertwined right now that you need technology and curriculum integration specialists to make sure that your technology is not driving the curriculum, that it's the other way around, that you choose your curriculum and then fit the technology into that. And there are people and specialists who are really good at doing that, but again, it costs money to hire them and to get their consulting services. We'd also like to get all counselors, more counselors in all of our schools. Minnesota is notoriously low on their counselor to student ratios. So, and that's just for SF 177, which was the bill just before this that was discussed, and that's just to adjust the factors. SF 569 seeks to put an index adjuster on that so that we're not 20 years later saying it hasn't been adjusted again, we're still in our old wardrobe. An index, if you're going to keep the system, an index adjuster on such as on SS 569 is a really good idea so that you're not back here in 5, 10, 15, 20 years again having this conversation once again.
Okay, thank you.
That's all I have to say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we do have three other people who want to testify, so if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
I'm Naomi Erickson, and I'm a new school board member in Waconia District. School District 110. I want to thank you for hearing us today, and I'm pleased to testify about Senate 177. My orientation as a new school board member gave me an opportunity to see very clearly that this is an issue of basic fairness. And I hope you all see it that way, and I hope you adjust it so that we can have equity in education for all Minnesota students.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Heidemann. Superintendent Richards and Ms. Dietrich, if you want to come forward, maybe we can bring another chair up there.
Absolutely.
If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, we're happy to have your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Tom Heidemann.
Mr. Heidemann.
I am the chairman of the Anoka-Hennepin School Board. I'd like to talk a little bit about who we are in Anoka-Hennepin, to give you a little bit of background of our school district. We serve 38,000 students in Anoka-Hennepin, and we cover the northern metro areas of 13 different communities. Our demographics are changing dramatically in this area. One-third of our students are in poverty, and that continues to grow. One-fourth of our students are students of color, and these numbers are doubling every decade. By 2023, we expect 50% of our students will be students of color, and two-thirds will be in poverty. In terms of a community, we have the lowest per capita income in the metro area, and we also have the lowest percentage of adults with college education, about 1 in 4. We have some good news as a school district. We graduate 3,000 students every year, the largest of any other school district in the state of Minnesota. We are also a school district with one of the lowest achievement gaps in reading in among all large school districts in the state of Minnesota. And just recently, to weather the storm of funding concerns over the last 2 years, we closed 8 facilities and now are recognized as being a school district that is the most effective in using space in the state of Minnesota.
He wants to keep it?
Yeah. From Anoka-Hennepin point of view, we have always been in support of equity. If you recall, some 20 years ago, it was the Anoka-Hennepin School District that came forward and challenged the funding systems within the state of Minnesota through the Skeen lawsuit. And I think it's important to note that if you look at Mr. Melcher's data, as you have, and we'll have time to dig into it, you will notice that we are almost back to the level of inequity in the state of Minnesota as when the lawsuit was brought forward. So we've eroded over time pretty significantly, and we're back to where we were, close, almost back where we were with the Skeen lawsuit. For Noke Hennepin, we do have local levy. In 2011, our voters passed a renewal for $48 million. Even though, with the funding mechanisms in the state of Minnesota, we pay three times more to raise that single dollar per student than other communities in the metro area. What we told our community was the state of Minnesota is broke. It can't fund inflation. If we don't have this levy, we are going to be having class sizes of 40 in our elementaries and 50 in our high school, that AP classes and our work to try to move more kids into college and secondary opportunities will be at risk. And therefore, as a community, even though we have to pay more, we have to carry the water locally in order to maintain these programs until the state of Minnesota's financial health is restored and they can start funding inflation and education. And that passed in Anoka Hennepin.
Excuse me, we do have three more testifiers, and
okay,
we're running out of time.
I will absolutely do that. So I talked a little bit about what that levy means to us. It is not about extra. It is about basic programs within Anoka Hennepin. And my last point, Madam Chair, is to recognize the fact that right now in both the House and Senate, there is not an inflationary bill to cover inflation in school districts. And what we're looking at is not even being able to cover steps and lanes in our contract. So from an equalization point of view, we have three choices. We either cut programs, we ask for more referendum from our voters, or we go to the unions after 4 years of a hard and soft freeze in Anoka Hennepin to go another 6 years in a hard or soft freeze. So that's the position we're in as a school district, and I really do appreciate the time for the testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Heidemann. Apparently, we adopted the A1 amendment that Senator Hoffman did not want, which was deleting that Section 1. Is that correct?
Correct.
Senator Eaton moves to reconsider the motion by which the A1 amendment was adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. So the A1 amendment is set aside. Superintendent Richards.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Chris Richardson. I'm the superintendent of the Northfield Public Schools and previously served as the superintendent of the Osseo Area Schools. I want to focus just very quickly on a couple pieces. I think as school districts, we want all the public school children in the state of Minnesota to have equal access to high-quality education regardless of where they live in Minnesota. I believe that both 569 and 177 are definitely great steps towards trying to address that issue for three reasons. First, I think they promote greater taxpayer fairness because they increase the equalization factors for equalized debt service, equity transition, and referendum equalization. And they try to get the situation where property taxes on two levies of equal size paid by taxpayers in different districts with equal property values will be more closer to the same amount. So really what we're trying to say, if you got a $100,000 house in Northfield, a $100,000 house in Edina, you're going to pay the same amount of money. Second piece, it adjusts the equalizing factors, which haven't been adjusted since 1993, and obviously are causing a major part of this problem with equalization because almost all districts have fallen off equalization and no longer have it available to help make it possible to either pass and or maintain those levies. And finally, in SF 569, we provide a mechanism that indexes or updates the equalizing factors yearly. That's the big problem with the current bill that you have in place right now, the current statute you have in place right now, is it hasn't changed anything since 1993, despite the fact that we've seen huge increases in property value. So the bottom line is, I think it levels the playing field, provides more equal opportunities for districts to pass and maintain levies, and it provides greater taxpayer equity, which I think is why It's in the tax committee because that's where it belongs. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Ms. Deidre? Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I would just like to remind members that the Minnesota School Boards Association represents over 2,000 locally elected school board members across the state. And so with that, Madam Chair, what I would like to do first of all is thank Senator Hoffman for bringing this bill forward, because as has been mentioned a couple of different times today already, that the state has increased its reliance on property taxes in order to fund public education in the state of Minnesota. And in fact, a property tax levy has become a necessity in adequately funding a general education in our state. As the result, over 90% of the school districts in our state right now have a property tax levy in order to fund their public school system. And within that, you will find a range of districts. Some districts have a $1 per pupil levy, and some districts have a $1,800 levy. The inability to pass a levy increases the inequity in education funding, which often translates into higher paid teachers, and that causes a problem for attractability, access to better programming. Wonderful innovative programs like AVID can be in one school district and not another. And it also creates a bigger inequity in technology in our school districts. And this is where the disparity lies. And it is a disparity, and it is an inequity. I would like to just give one example. Since the Anoka-Hennepin group is here today, I will use them as an example. In the Anoka-Hennepin school district, a homeowner with a $100,000 home pays $202 in local property taxes to generate $900 per pupil in their district in a referendum levy. Now, the homeowner in Bloomington, home of Mall of America, with the same value home, pays $110 in property taxes in a $100,000 home to generate that same amount of revenue for their students. This is not equitable, and it will never be equitable as long as we rely on property taxes to fund our public education system. That is our reality. But because that is our reality, the state has a constitutional obligation to equalize that inequity. And so what I would like to do is just point out then that the state has not kept up with its constitutional obligation to fairly and adequately fund public education by pointing you to these. There are several charts in your packets, but I will just point you to two of them, the two bar graphs. One is for debt service, and that all I will point out on that chart is that in 1995, the state...
Ms. Dietrich, are these the handouts that are the Ehlers ones?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And what this does is it shows how much the state aid has gone down into debt payments from 1995 to 2013 as a percent of the debt payments. The point is that in 1995, over 11% the state was putting into those payments, and it has now fallen to around 2%. And that is accountable to the fact that the equalization factors have not increased. The next chart is one that looks more like this, with the really small bottom there for a while. All this I will point out on this one is that the percent of referendum revenue shows on a statewide basis of how much referendum is received by districts as aid and how much it has changed over time. In 1997, 63% of the referendum was state aid. And now as you look down to 2013, it is 1.9%. It is practically nil. And so I just wanted to share those with you to demonstrate the point that the state has not kept up with its state's obligation on the equalization piece. And so hence we support Senator Hoffman's bill, because it allows an inflation factor so that trend will never happen again. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Senator Hoffman, did you have a final comment at all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking this important task on. And I would be remiss if I didn't just look at, for the last 8 years on the school board, this was a reminder for me, and it's Article 13, and it's got some wonderful words, and the, it's the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. And I'll leave you with that, because let's keep this conversation going, and I appreciate your time here today. Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Thank you
very much, Senator Hoffman, Ms. Dietrich. Senator Skoy, final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and to the public. We're going to lay Senate File 177 and Senate File 569 on the table for continued effort, and I want to bring up the problem that has occurred to us with regard to equalization funding earlier this week.
All right. Okay.
And it has to do with the property tax recognition shift, and I think Dr. Melcher is going to come back to the table for a very brief comment on if there is any way for us to get around the problem. And what the problem is that for every dollar we spend in equalizing, we have to spend 48.6 cents to repay the property tax recognition shift. The property tax recognition shift was one of the shift mechanisms that's been used to balance the state budgets the last number of years. And for this effort to equalize, it appears to be a hurdle that we're going to have to overcome. And maybe Dr. Melcher would have some creative solutions if he thinks there might be. And I don't know if there is or if there isn't. And if there isn't, just tell us.
Before we do that, we need another step with regard to that A1 amendment. Senator Eaton withdraws the A1 amendment. Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. In order to balance the state budget in 2011, the legislature directed the school districts to recognize 48% of their property tax early. That's basically the entire first half tax settlement. So rather than holding that money until July 1 and using it for the new school year, they've been told to use that money for the prior school year, and on a one-time basis, we saved about $550 million by doing that. We're pretty much capped out on the property tax shift because we're essentially taking the whole first half tax settlement. So whenever we have a bill that reduces school levies, other than a few levies that are not subject to the shift, like debt service levies, there is going to be a cost. What you're doing, in effect, is paying back part of that $550 million. And I don't see an easy way of avoiding doing that payback. If you do lower levies, you're going to have to adjust that payback. I don't believe it's possible for the state to shift the second half of the property tax, which doesn't arrive until November. That's just too much of a gap in terms of timing.
Thank you. I'm sure that Senator Skoy is going to find a way of overcoming that hurdle.
Well, Madam Chair, I just don't like paying $1.50 for a dollar worth of property tax relief. But we're going to keep working on it.
And I'm sure the discussion is going to get even broader as we hear from other school districts throughout the state and what the impact of these proposals would have on them, positive or negative. Tomorrow, we meet in the division. We're taking up the article dealing with the governor's tobacco tax proposals and also other members' proposals dealing with tax on tobacco. Senator Skoy, do you have anything further?
Madam Chair and members, we are putting together an agenda for next week in the full committee. It will be a number of members' bills, and we're putting that together, and we'll try to have it out to you by tomorrow.
And the division will not be meeting next week. There being no further business in front of the committee, we stand adjourned.